Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conservationist Assemble podcast, a show that seeks to unite Earth's mightiest advocates in the mission to ensure a future for our planet's incredible habitats and its awesome inhabitants. I am your host, Johnny Bloxham, and today's episode is a story of extinction and rewilding. We are talking about the northern bald ibis and the incredible work of zoos in contributing to the existence of this species today. Join the podcast and today's expert guests as we discuss everything about this species and the conservation efforts directed at their survival. This week's guests are none other than Christiane Bohm and Julianne Piccorni, both former and current coordinator for the Northern Bald Ibis Breeding Programme at the Alpen Zoo in Innsbruck. Please welcome them both as they join the ranks of the Conservationist Assemble initiative to put their passion, knowledge and expertise on the Northern Bald Ibis and their conservation. Christiane and Julianne, thank you for joining us today on the podcast. How's it going?
Fine
till now, yeah. Hello.
Great. I'm happy to hear that you're both doing well, and I'm thrilled to be discussing the northern bald ibis with you. And I can't wait to hear your thoughts on this ecologically significant species. So firstly, can you please tell us a little bit about the northern bald ibis?
The bald ibis is a rather distinct species, very easy to say this is northern bald ibis, a typical ibis, about 75-80 centimeter big. It's black plumage with a special purple shine on it. And as the name say, it's a bald ibis, so there are no feathers on their head. It's a long curved bill, very soft bill, and red feet. What's so typical is that an ibis, it's a gregarious species. So the worst thing for a bald ibis is to be alone. And therefore, they always love to be in a group. And even in the wild, it's a group and you have a special hierarchy within the group. But you can't, it's very hard to find out which is the high ranking specimen because you hardly see any aggression. Except breeding season, then it's really aggressive period. It's feeding mainly on insects, big insects, beetles, but it also goes for snails, lizards, small passerines if possible, tadpoles. It's very open in its diet. If you think about the typical habitat, you would say it's a semi-arid species, which is a bit unusual for ibises because it's many ibises are very close to water, and the bald ibis is a really terrestrial species. And there's a twin species, the southern bald ibis, which lives in very similar habitats and living in same areas. The scientific name with Geronticus eremita is a bit strange because it's so living in big colonies, but the Geronticus means this is bald head, which is really like in humans. When they get older, they got bald. And this starts in the second year of their life. They're losing feathers on the top of the head. And this is going on to the fourth year when the chin is getting bald as well. What is very distinctive is the black pattern on the head. And this is individual. So you can distinguish the individual by the pattern. In former days, people believed it has something to do with age, but this is not true. So it's really, we have some colonies where a lot of birds have very black heads and others don't. So if you're very familiar with the colony, you can distinguish it just by the head patterns, so no rings are necessary.
Well, that's really interesting. I suppose that really then benefits to the reintroduction program, which we'll be discussing a bit later on.
Yeah. They're breeding always in a colony, and the typical is, and therefore probably they got the name eremita, the Latin name, because they're having their nest site high up in cliffs. And there they are sitting very close together, just the hacking distance of the bills. there's really fighting going on when they sit on the nest sites and they're quarreling about nest material. And the males are sitting on the nest. They're selecting the nest sites, and the higher ranking have the best spots. Mm-hmm. And then the females are choosing the males. And they breed together. Both partners do breed. They have up 3 to 5 eggs. And after 4 weeks, the chicks hatch. And mostly 2 to 3 chicks can hatch because they have a very hard sibling competition. Mm. When one chick is about a week old, they start to hack on the younger one. And this is, if it is not enough food, it gets weaker and weaker, and it's too shy to beg, and therefore it gets weaker and will die. So in the field, you often have, in the wild area, you have about 1 to 2 chicks which are fledging. But in zoos, when the food is really abundant, there can be 3 to 4, but it's rare. But this sibling competition stops when the one chick is 3 years old and the younger one starts with this behavior. So it's not really a kind of kinism, it's really competition about food.
Fantastic. And so what role do the northern bald ibis play in their ecosystem, or why are they such an important species that we need to be talking about them?
That's, for me, a bit difficult question, because I think in the ecosystem it's probably not the key role species. But it's interesting from the historical point of view, because humans have always been very interested in the species. And probably it's one of the first species where a conservation decree was published. And this was done in Salzburg, where there was a colony close to the city of Salzburg in Austria. And the Archbishop forbid the people to shoot out of the windows into the nesting sites. So from this development here, we know that there had been bald ibises in Europe, but they disappeared. And again, when it was found again, we had a decline in the populations. And for the conservation history, probably it's a key role species, because we learn so much about how people are acting or doing conservation and the come outs of it. It's a typical species for extensive used pastures and landscapes. But I wouldn't say it's a follower of human cultivation, because when it really comes in close contact to people, it's a hard time for the bald ibis, and it gets in troubles.
So for a species that's had kind of a long history with humans, what are the current classification trend and population trends for the northern bald ibis?
If you would have asked me 20 years ago, we'd say, oh, not very nice. But at the moment, to be honest, everything is quite thriving, I would say. The last wild populations, up to 800 birds. We have in Turkey a semi-wild population, up to 300 birds. The zoo population is huge, with 2,000 living birds, but we have data of 6,000 birds. And we have two introduction projects, which have about 250 birds. So not bad. The big problem the bald ibis has, that it's located on just two sites, and mm-hmm. One in Morocco and one in Turkey, and the colony breeders. And colony breeders are more open to dangers, and one event can be much more damaging if you're a colony breeder.
And so what we kind of, I suppose, next steps then would be looking to secure more suitable habitat for further reintroductions?
This would be one step. And it would be very, very interesting. We had been, there had been about 50, 40, 48 colonies in Morocco until the 60s. And then it disappeared quite quickly. And it would be very interesting to know why the birds disappeared. And often, and we don't have very good data about it, but we know that often the change in the land use made a difference. And they are quite prone to disturbance. They are very shy and neophobic. But if you have in a zoo, you learn that they can be open-minded as well. Mm-hmm. So it's the thing about the bald eye is that it always astonishes you. The more you learn it, the more you know you don't know so much.
Yeah, definitely. And so we've talked about how being a colony bird, they're quite susceptible to one event as a whole colony. What are the threats to the bald ibis and where are they coming from?
The threats in the Middle Ages where they disappeared probably has been hunting, a persecution. It was for the higher hierarchy, it was a special food. There are receipts about it, how to cook it, how to keep it. Even they said that they kept them. And then they disappeared in the 16th, 17th century. Probably the Little Ice Age was responsible for that too. When the colonies declined at the beginning of the 20th century, it was mainly persecution as well and hunting. And it was using in the 50s, especially in Turkey, DDT against malaria around the area of Biricik. And there are hundreds of them died quickly. And not only the birds, but also cattle. So they used it really heavily. Probably in the Middle East, it was hunting. And it's still there, very high hunting pressure because people have more money there and hunting is forbidden, but it's done. And in Morocco, it was the land use. It was also hunting. And what we forget a bit about Northern Africa is that this countryside is used for more than 5,000-6,000 years now by humans. And it's not a natural habitat. And I think it become drier and drier. And of course, more and more overgrazing is happening there because as I learned, the grazing management is different. They put now their cattle on big trucks, transfer them there. The goats get out, eat everything, and then they're gone. And the bald ibis is there where they probe between little shrubs for the beetles, for the snails. And this can be very damaging, and this is very quick.
Okay, so in terms of efforts to try and prevent those threats and obviously bolster the wild population, are there any in-situ conservation programs for the bald ibis that exist and that zoos are partnering up with?
There are quite some in-situ projects, one, and they are done by the government of Turkey and as well of Morocco. They feel responsible for it, and Turkey's... It started when the decline in Turkey happened in the 60s, 50s. They thought of having a captive population and then adding birds when they're breeding well. But they learned quickly that it's not happening so easily. First, the breeding wasn't so well. And secondly, the released birds didn't join the wild. The last wild birds and go with them because there was a migrating population going to the south. We didn't quite know where they're going to, but they're wintering in Ethiopia. And then they started up with having a sedentary colony because no birds were coming back from the wintering grounds. And after some years, I started ringing and found out that it's very important to know which pairs were breeding with whom. And this was very successful way for starting a better breeding performance. But my impression is as well that if you have a small group, the breeding stimulation is much less. Mm-hmm. And when it's getting bigger and bigger, success is coming eat much more easily. What's special with Turkey is that they have them in an aviary for 3-4 months, and then they release them in February. The birds go out, choose their nest sites. They provide a bit of food, but they can go everywhere they want to. And in autumn, they feed them in again in the aviary. Of course, not everybody's coming into it, and some are out, but a big proportion is going into the aviary. So this is very helpful, and they now thinking of having a second aviary in a different spot to get a bit, to have the risk a bit separated. In Morocco, they had been down to 150 birds, and just in close to Agadir, this is a population who lives on the cliffs of the Atlantic, very hard to have access to the nest sites, and of course not very good for the birds. So they founded a national park, Souss-Massa National Park, extra for the bald ibis, and they had a bad accident in 1996 where a lot of birds died, and it was probably mainly to botulism. Mm-hmm. And they started now to provide water ponds, which are filled every day with fresh water, and around midday it should be emptied, and birds use it quite nicely, and this brought a better breeding success, and it's really going on since this time, and they're now with 800 birds. So there's some good feeling that they will expand their from this colony to the Middle Atlas, to the coast further north. Which sounds very promising.
That is fantastic. And so what actions are zoos taking to help combat the threats to the northern bald ibis?
I'm sorry again, me, to say that. I was invited in 1999 to a meeting to learn about the in situ projects and all the colleagues. And I think it's we formed the international advisory group for the northern bald ibis. And I think we as zoos can provide a lot of experience how to keep it, how to manage it. And we learned a lot of the colleagues who are working in the wild. So this group didn't just give information from experts to amateurs. So, but we could exchange our knowledge on a horizontal basis, which I think is very interesting, because you often hear about things, so just you have to wait for papers to get to know what's happening. But often people take a long time to publish it. And so with oral communication, a direct communication, we could form up much more information and could exchange it. And we in the zoo did learn a lot, and the other way around as well. We also could publish meeting proposals, which was very helpful as well. And in this time, the release approaches were, of course, coming up, because we had so many birds and good breeding success in zoos. So the idea was, why don't we want to release the bald ibis? There had been some releases beforehand. It was one in Tel Aviv and some experimental releases here in the Alpen, so in Austria. But we learned that it's not so easy, because they have some tendency to migrate. But actually, it is not very, the direction is not so clear for them, doesn't seem clear for them.
So you brought the breeding and release program up nicely there. And I'd actually then like to build a bit more on that. So could you tell us, please, about the purpose and the function of the Northern Bald Ibis Studbook?
Yeah, that's my turn. Stud books are something like the dating agency for endangered animal species, and the goal is to build a self-sustaining and stable zoo animal population, which only can be achieved if genetic variability is high. And the stud book provides all the information about who matches who, and the stud book coordinator can use this data to make useful breeding and transfer recommendations. So me or the EEP coordinators there for the liaison between all the holders, and I collect all the data about the animals and make recommendations if possible, and or I include which animal, or I decide which animals are made available for release programs, for example. And I hope to help all the holders with questions about the animals and how to keep it or to hold it at the closures and there. And previously the data was transmitted analog and everything took a lot of more time. I think Christiane can tell you a lot about it, about this time. Now the data transmission is very quick, but keeping the data up to date is still an intensive task, and I'm dependent on all the institutions and all the Nordenwald ibis holders that I get the data, the correct data, and I have to hold a good communication and a good contact with all the holders.
Yeah, and I imagine, because Christiane mentioned that there was quite a healthy population of bald ibis in zoos, so I'm assuming that there's a lot of people and a lot of holders to be communicating with.
Yeah, at the moment we have 102 institutions.
So this is a very active breeding program.
Big step book, yeah.
what I thought is very, very precious about EPs, so very good about EPs, is that we were keeping them, and there was the idea of breeding them for release programs, and then we find out, we don't know so much. And I think what's the most positive thing of EEP is that you started doing research on keeping, on feeding, how are relations between pairs. And this is, I think, the most probably in future, the most important role of EEPs. It's not just providing animals for releases, but to know the species as well. And this is what we really have to not to forget, in my point of view. For the bald ibis, we had some imports, about 120 birds in the 50s, all from the Western colony, not from Turkey, which are the migrating colony. And out of these breeders, all the birds we have now, up to 2,000, are stemming from this few birds. It's for an EEP, 120 is fine, but actually, it's not so much if you think about the number and the number now. But so far, we didn't have any sign of inbreeding or different behavior than in the field, to be honest, which is very interesting. What is very positive also is that the bald ibis are very long living species. It's up to 34, 35, even 49 was the oldest bird.
Wow.
And they're breeding, yeah, it's quite old, yeah. I would say if I want to get old, I want to be a bird, because they're fertile until the end. Don't see anything. It's just molting in the end is a bit hard for them. But, and it's even interesting that they form up pairs with 20, 25. I had a female with 26, and she was pairing up with a juvenile male of 3 years, and they were doing fine. So it's always thing very interesting that there are new pairs. They do pair every year with a new partner, but for some years they can stay with the same partner for 3-4 years, and they're doing better. Quite interesting that they're splitting up then. I don't know why. Still an interesting question.
Yeah, it's very important to also interesting rather to kind of look at an EEP from the research side of things, and to bring it back to a point you made earlier about how larger groups had that bigger stimulation towards breeding. Are you seeing zoos reflecting that in the way that they are housing bald ibis? Are you finding that one collection is housing more to kind of mimic that stimulation of breeding?
Yeah, I find out that at least six to eight birds are necessary to get a breeding stimulation. Otherwise, you won't. And a good age structure is important. You should have 2/3 adult birds and some young birds. So age structure is quite important. If in the 70s, when just 3-4 colonies were breeding well, everybody wanted bald ibis. So we're giving out all the young ones. And then we find out after 10 years, our group is getting old. We are the young ones. So we have to have a good age structure to keep it lively. And especially when the young are becoming adults and interested in nesting, they interfere in the old with the old pairs. They're splitting up. And what is quite interesting, the student looking up about the pair bonding, and they find out that the good breeding pairs are not starting earlier, but they're doing everything quicker. They're quicker in nest sites, occupation, in nest building. Copulation are less, but more real copulations. And then they're breeding and having the chicks and raising them. Young pairs are starting to nest site and nest building. There's communication problems. The copulations are much more often, but much more non-real copulations. So they're a bit playing around. And this is, I think, quite interesting. Therefore, an older experienced partner is very attractive for a young one, because with this one, I probably have really breeding success.
Yeah, that is interesting. And it really does show the importance of being able to observe those behaviours and what it can do for conservation. So in terms of other species now, because it, like you said, it has been quite a successful programme, do you think there's anything that we could take away from the bald ibis model of EEP and reintroduction that could be or should be applied to other species that we might be considering to reintroduce?
If you look at reintroduction programs, I think you have to be a long breath, to be honest, because if you start and you think in 3-4 years I'm there, you won't. And if you look to, for instance, at the bearded vulture program, they started in the 70s, and they really had a proposal how to do it step by step, and they're still doing it. So it's now 40, 45 years. And the same is a bit true about the bald ibis. We started with a young bee in 99 and thought about the release. It wasn't they weren't release projects at the beginning. They were just projects who wanted to find a method how to release it, a kind of soft release. And now they're reintroduction programs. But even those are running now for 20 years, and they're still working on it, and still not. There's quite a big group, but I wouldn't say it's a safe group, not a self-sustaining group. So it's time you need. Mm-hmm. And probably more than one career, probably 3-4 careers are doing it. Yeah, I think this is what you can learn from the bald ibis especially, which is a bit of a complicated species, but maybe it's true for many other species as well.
No, it's certainly, I think, yeah, like you say, a lot of people will look at how a particular species model has been successful and what elements they can apply to that. So it's great to have such an open and kind of well-established model to use for reference. So aside from the research and the breeding program, what other work or resources do zoos help in terms of funding?
For example, awareness campaigns make a lot of that, and a wide variety of projects are supported with money for staff, energy costs, for example, or tax, transmitters, or food, or so. And also with animals for release projects, including the transport costs, for example, that don't pay for.
Yeah, fantastic. And yeah, I think, yeah, again, it's always important to look or to certainly educate people on what goes on behind closed doors in zoos, because it's easy just to think that we're here to house these animals for display. But yeah, it's like I say, it's the education and it's all of the support that goes out to in-situ conservation projects as well. So what really got you both interested or involved with northern bald ibis in the first place? Where did that inspiration come from?
Actually, I was just thrown into it in the bald ibis. I'm a bird person, and I love birds, but I'm more dedicated to passerines. But when I started here in the Alpen Zoo, which had the EP, so my first task was to put in all the data of the bald ibis, and it was already 330 data birds she had to put in. And then afterwards I had the transfer of one program to another one. I think now it's the third one, so I'm happy that I'm retired now. I have to get on with a new program again, which all were fine, but all have, of course, bugs and problems and this kind of thing. But what fascinated me about the bald ibis and in the end now is he's such a strong species, and he can cope with much more things than we thought. If we had at the meeting in 99, we had a translator who said, oh, this bird isn't for the 21st century, but it's still there. And it's stronger here than when we have thought. And if you said what we learned of this model, and if you think about different methods, the method of keeping and releasing them in the field and catching them in, like in Turkey, no hands on in Morocco, they don't touch the birds. They hardly catch any birds for tagging. They are very, very shy to do them because the birds are very shy there. And they are doing fine there. They just provide things. And if you think about the zoos who had been very bad breeders in the 70s, 60s, and now from the 80s on, it went well because we know better husbandry, about feeding, how to deal with groups. And then the different release projects, which one in Spain is establishing a sedentary group. They get them into an aviary during the winter season that they don't disperse. And they have built up after heavy losses of more than, they got 400 birds from the EP, which is not few. And then they lost the first years a lot of birds. And after some years, they stayed because the group was getting bigger, and then they started to breed in the field. And then the migration model here in Austria of the Waldrop team, which do hand rear them, which show them how to migrate where. And they also get about 400 birds, also had heavy losses, and they still lose them. So you have to have a lot of birds to put in there. And of course, juvenile mortality is, of course, high. They're inexperienced. They have to learn a lot. And with this different methods, all of these things are thriving now, which I think very interesting. It shows that probably it's not this method which helps, but to have a lot of birds, to have a long breath, a long time, and give you time, and to learn from each area you're making, and then say, okay, we'll try it another way.
Yeah, I think it certainly shows the resilience of the people committed to conserving them, but it also shows how hardy the bald ibis is, and like you say, is a testament as to why they are still around today. So do you have any kind of, or do you remember your first experience with a bald ibis, or do you have a particular individual ibis that you gained a fondness for?
Yeah, it's just so long living their personalities, of course. You have some guys who are really on the top, and we had some wild birds who was never finding a partner. He was. Was it uninteresting or stupid? I didn't know. Quite strange that. So I think these personalities within the colonies is very nice, and I don't like to give animals names, but Waldrops I did give names because they are so typical for that. And there was especially one story of one female, and I think it's very interesting because she was the only daughter of one pair, and she was pairing up with a high-ranking male there, and she was very productive. And I think now she's in 300 or 400 birds within the EP, because she had very successful offsprings as well. So, and after 3-4 years, she lost her partner. And because he was sent away, unfortunately, and when he was coming back, he was totally uninteresting for her because he was not high ranking again. So what makes a bald ivy sexy is quite interesting. And so we can learn a lot of these kind of personalities. Why do some birds good and why don't they? And I think in the field, it's not different. It's not in the zoo. And what I was always happy with, that as a EEP coordinator, I hadn't to decide which bird has to pair up with whom. I have a colony. They can select. Mm. So I have some kind of natural sexual selection. And this is quite, I think, quite good. And probably this helps a lot against inbreeding as well.
Yeah, I can imagine that is a quite an interesting element to an EEP. So we know that you're now enjoying retirement. Julianne, how did you get into this career? And give us an insight into your background, please.
Yeah, I studied zoology here in Innsbruck and was able to write my master thesis in the Alpen Zoo with Christiane. Not about the northern bald ibis, but about house sparrows. But afterwards, I somehow ended in Linz Zoo. It's a small zoo in Upper Austria. And come back to Tyrol for family reasons. And then now had to wait a lot of years until I got this job here and Christiane wanted to retire. And yeah, it's a big heritage. And I'm working every day on getting more confident in this new tasks and so. But I think it would take a lot of more years to get this knowledge like Christiane now have.
Yeah, it certainly is experience that only comes with a lengthy career. So are you also as equally interested in birds as well, or is avian the field that you are pursuing?
Yeah, I always loved birds very much, but I didn't work as a specialist with them, because in Linz Zoo I was responsible for all animals, and we didn't have such a lot of European species there, so it's now a lot of tasks are new here. So because we have European species or species from the Alps. And now, yeah, I have to learn every day.
Yeah.
It's interesting, but yeah, hard work.
Yeah, I can imagine. So are there any particular species that have kind of taken your or surprise that you never really considered working with before?
Which I'm interested in species or whatever. I would love to know and work more with woodpeckers. I think they are very interesting birds, and I'm dreaming of having a really big aviary for woodpeckers here in the Alpen Zoo. But yeah, let's see, maybe one day.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. There's certainly a species that you hear quite often, but you don't really see them that often. So yeah, to be able to see woodpeckers really frequently would be really, really lovely. So who were the influences in your career and on your career path?
For me, it was the curator before me. It was Ellen Thaler. She was very in love with the bald ibis. And she did initiate a lot of work on behavioral study. So this was a very good stock work I could start for. And the form of bird keeping she was teaching me was very, very interesting. So it's really to get to know a species, to look at behavior. And I did my PhD in the field with the water pipit, small passerine birds in high altitudes. And this was a great time for me. So behavior is really something I am very interested in. And the zoo is ideal for working with behavior. And here in the Alpen Zoo, with having alpine species and species, the same species outside. So if you're not sure what you're seeing, you have the chance to go in the field quite quickly and to learn how it fits. And this, I think, is very special in the Alpenzoo and very interesting in the Alpenzoo to work here.
Yeah, it's really cool and quite unique in a sense.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, for me, it was the second director of Alpenzoo, Helmut Bechlerner, because I grew up not far here from the zoo, and I visited the zoo a lot of times as a child, and I was very impressed from his work. And of course, Christiane, because at the end of my master's thesis, she told me it will be hard to find a job. And she said, mine would be the right for you, but I'm not giving up this job. And well, maybe she gave me the vision I needed, because after all, I only had to wait now 16 years until she gave it up. So now I'm here.
Yeah, it's nice, obviously, then for you, Christiane, that you've been able to watch Julianne kind of bloom into the role, or fit into the role that she's doing, or that you were once doing. So what does a typical day look like for you now, Julianne?
No day is like the other. As the creator of the birds, or for the birds in the Alpenzoo, I'm the contact person for the animal keepers in this area. We discuss enclosure facilities, food for the animals, as well as renovations and construction projects. And food has to be ordered, animal transport has to be organized. And as the coordinator, I'm sitting a lot of in front of the computer and cleaning up the data and correspondence with the holders, indeed. All in all, I spend a lot of time in front of the computer. Mm-hmm. I would love to be more outside in the zoo, but yeah, it has to be done here.
And so what advice would you give to someone looking to pursue a career in conservation?
You have more advice.
Probably being open-minded, what you do. A lot of people start with mammals. I wanted to work with mammals as well. Ended up with birds, which I think it's very good and very nice, because behavior is much more, not more interesting, but much easier to learn a lot about. Because a lot of zoologists who work with mammals hardly have a chance to see it, observe it, because it's so shy or nocturnal or whatever. And to try everything. And I started here in the Alpenzoo during holidays as a student and worked as a keeper. So you learn a lot when you do the work. You afterward think they should do it. But if you've done it by yourself, you know what's possible and what is not. So I think being open-minded, networking, get a lot of excursions, get to know people here around, which is easier nowadays than it has been, to be honest. But to have an idea and to follow it, mm-hmm. and luck, of course. Luck is always necessary. And patient, yeah, which I don't have, so.
Some very good advice there. So Julianne, you mentioned that you came to the zoo a lot as a child. Christiane, what was your first experience with the zoo?
The first was when I was here, working here, because I always wanted to do being a field biologist, to be honest. If I'm traveling, actually, I don't visit zoos. I want to see the animals in the field. I do some birding. And when I was going to a lecture of Ellen Thaler, she was talking about goldcrests and firecrests. This was her specialty. She was breeding them, and I was fascinated what she was telling me. And then I wanted to work here. And then I learned that it's not just keeping animals in an aviary or in an enclosure. it was to start to think what they need, what they like, how they appreciate it. And I'm more a person who like to provide things and look how they like it. I don't like the action and I don't need that. I'm more interested in observing it and having a look. And if you start doing it like that, it's very, very interesting, because you see that birds are more capable than we think. They are more open-minded. There is more individuals than you think, especially also in passerines, not only in long-living species. So this is interesting. And so not every day is the same. And what I think in a zoo, working in a zoo, is makes so special that you have contact with so many different species. As a field worker, you hardly ever have. And this is really gorgeous, and I'm very happy to have had that.
Fantastic. And so then, what do you think is A, you know, commonly misunderstood about zoos, but B, some of the biggest challenges surrounding conservation?
So I would say the big misunderstanding is that I think the zoos are experts in keeping, and this is where we're really good on. But the main task probably we have is education, because we have to transfer this information we have and the knowledge we have. And a lot of people still think that they're in cages and they are poor and they are suffering. And I think we are far away from this kind of thing. If you go back in the 60s or 50s, of course it was different, but our attitude to animals has changed so much. So nowadays it's always, especially the 80s and the early 90s, have been done big steps to animal welfare, to better husbandry, to better keeping, but we are still learning. And a lot of things have, especially EPs, helped them to understand why don't they breed? Did we mix up wrong partners? And for this, we learned that vultures and parrots have contact when they are young. They have to choose their partners. Sexual selection in the field is very, very, there are a lot of papers around it, and we ignore it in the zoo. So we have learned a lot. And this learning process, I think we should inform our public more about what kind of work we are doing. But a lot of people coming here to enjoy themselves, of course, and the education part is, I think, the most different thing, that people really get some of the information and take it home.
Yeah, very poignant. And zoos do have a lot to shout about and be proud about. So yeah.
I think so, yeah. Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. So if you could improve one thing about this industry, what would it be? Would it be the education?
It would be education, yeah. I think we can learn a lot of museums. People like to touch things, but it shouldn't be like I was once in a zoo and it was huge educational thing, and then you got out and have seen the tiger and was sleeping and it was boring. This shouldn't be like that. So the living animal, I think, is always the most important thing we can show. Mm-hmm. And probably what is very, very lucky here in the Alpen Zoo, that we are restricted to a small group of smaller group of animals. So we have to think about it. And to think about the whole package, how to transfer people, alpine environment is. It's not just the summits, it's the wallows as well. And I think what we could improve, and is always improving, is keeping, how to keep animals. We'll always learn, and there's not a receipt. You have to be open-minded, yeah.
It's a really interesting point, actually, about kind of the limit to the species that you house at Alpen Zoo. So in the UK, native species are becoming quite popular, and a lot of people enjoy learning about native species. Are you seeing that reflected in Tyrol as well?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, a lot of people are quite open to learning about the species that they share.
Because A lot of people know lions and zebras, but not the common birds around the garden, which is quite astonishing.
Yes, fantastic. It's great to hear that everyone's kind of getting on board with
because nature is just outside of your house. Just have a look.
Yeah, amazing. So Juliana, what gives you motivation for the future of your role?
Biggest motivation is to be part of this big SEU communication, where there is really no competition and everybody's working together you're a part of a puzzle, but yeah, everybody's working and making the world a little bit better, or trying to do it.
Yeah, definitely. It's a very community-based approach. And so that brings us to the end of kind of talking about the Bald Ibis and both of your careers respectively. So we're just going to finish up with some fun questions before we leave today. So are there any dream species that either the both of you would love to work with or to see in the wild?
For me, it's different. To see in the wild, I would love to see a snow leopard and an armor leopard. It was a bit a dream, but I wouldn't like to work with it. It must be very hard. I'm still interested in the water pipit, very interesting. And the ring ouzlers, as species, I find very interesting, because living here and breeding here and then going in the Mediterranean. And what I think is interesting too, but I think very hard to it, would be very, very interesting to learn why some species are so common and so thriving and some are not. Mm-hmm. What makes a difference? And you even have species that have been very low and had troubles and then are coming again. And we should look at this, why they are recovering. What is the reason? I think this would be very helpful for conservation as well.
I agree, definitely.
Yeah, I would sign all these too. But as I said, I would love to see more woodpeckers and mm-hmm. work with them.
Yeah, I hope you do get to do that in the future. And how about countries or continents? Are there any countries or continents that you'd love to visit?
Yeah, for me, I think it's Brazil. I've been there many times, but that's such a huge country and there's for sure a lot of to visit, or a lot of places to visit and a lot of animals to see.
Yeah, great answer.
All continents are gorgeous, but I'm an mountainous person. I love to see mountains. Mm-hmm. And the Andes, I have been there, but not very short time. So where are mountains? I think it's interesting for me. Gorgeous.
Mm. Amazing. And if you could be an animal, what would it be and why?
Yeah, we talked about this a few days ago, but we both choose the raven.
The raven is interesting. Yeah. Long living, very human-like in some behavior. So very interesting. But the ravens are a gorgeous group.
Yeah, anyway. Really cool birds. Yeah.
Elegant animals.
Yeah,
very cool. And so when you're not working, how do you keep busy?
My kids keep me busy. And I think they're just starting puberty at the same time, both of them. So, or it feels like this. But they keep me busy, yeah. And I take a lot of work to home, because mm-hmm. I'm not that much that long in Alpensu, and I have to get more confident in a lot of tasks, and so I read a lot, and it's so at the moment only work and children for me.
And I'm retired, so I don't have time anymore for anything. You know how it is. Yeah, there's no excuse not to do it now, because I can do. But I have two daughters, and I have a grandson, which is a gorgeous one, and I will soon have a second one. So till the third year, I think they're like small animals. So I love them. They're really gorgeous. They're so open-minded. And what we can learn from children, I think that they're so happy. They're so interested in everything. Everything is new and gorgeous and interesting. And this is amazing to observe. I love that. But I have my garden, I do birding, so I'm not bored, not at all.
That's good. Yeah, I'm glad to hear. And so last question then, what is one thing that you think our listeners should take away from today's episode?
Sorry, I didn't get it.
So what is the one thing that you think our listeners should really take away from today's episode?
For me, it's that conservation is very hard work. It's networking. And you're often disappointed that it does take such a long time. But probably it's a reason because it's not one person alone who's pushing it. There are many things who are coming into it if government is involved, because that's much more complicated. It's the countryside, the distance. But probably on the other side, it's good because slowly you're building up a community who is carrying the whole thing. And this is probably for the species. It's better than it's one person, because if this person is gone, everything will collapse. So if a big community is in the back, and if you build up good knowledge about the species, then you have good chances that it will work.
Fantastic point to end up on. So a massive shout out to you both for appearing on the podcast and sharing your knowledge about the bald ibis and the incredible work that zoos have helped contribute to. We'll be sure to continue watching any developments on bald ibis reintroductions. And wish you all of the best. So thank you for your time today. A massive thank you to Julianne and Christiane once again for all of their hard work in conservation and their time on the Conservationist Assemble podcast today. But as always, a huge thank you to all of you for tuning in and supporting the show. If you did enjoy this episode, please like, share and review or rate the podcast, as it helps us to keep improving and spreading the word on the conservation efforts taking place around the world. Don't forget that you can always follow and interact with the podcast on Instagram, Facebook or via email. I've been your host, Johnny Bloxham, and I hope to see you all next time.